Now, before I start, the first thing is that you need the handout for today, and you need the handout from last time, which is over here. I will have office hours today and Wednesday in 744 Mud. If I'm overwhelmed, we'll move somewhere else. On Thursday, I think we'll be in 900 Fairchild. Exams are not graded yet. They will be returned, we hope, after class on Thursday, and the key will be posted either today or tomorrow. Okay. Now, last time at the end of class, we were discussing what happens if you cross, say, one heterozygote with another, and you get the offspring. Now, traditionally, what you do is you start with two homozygotes, and you get the F1, or the heterozygote, and then you cross two heterozygotes to get an F2. And we considered both how you get the genotypes and how you get the phenotypes thereof. And we discussed, in particular, when we said that the general procedure for doing a cross, and we're going to come back to that today, is you have to get the genotypes of the parents right, then you have to figure out their gametes, then you have to put the gametes together to make zygotes, and then you have to figure out first the genotypes of the zygotes, and then their phenotypes. Now, we were discussing last time how you do this, in particular, what phenotypes you get. And we said that when you cross this, the genotypes are always in the ratio of homozygote to heterozygote to homozygote to 1 to 2 to 1. But the interesting question is, what are the phenotypes? We know what is the phenotype of this one. And perhaps I should have used A and A star in order not to prejudice the answer. And we said that what happens depends on what the function of the product of the alleles is. That, and in some cases, the product of the appropriate allele may in fact be inactive and do nothing. But what the heterozygote is going to be like is going to depend on not on the alleles themselves, but on their products. And it could be that having a mixture of the product of big A and little a, your phenotype is like big A, big A, or it could be like little a, or it could be in between. Now, we also discussed the situation for sex-linked genes. Now, the procedure for a gene on the X is the same. You set up the parents, the gametes, the zygotes, blah, blah. But one of the reasons we did that example first is when you consider a gene on the X, you don't have to worry about dominance. You don't have to worry about the cells in the heterozygote. Because for genes on the X, remember when you have two X's, in any individual cell, one X is inactivated. So only the other X has a working allele. So in any individual cell, you get only the product of big A or the product of little a. So there is no issue of dominance on a cellular level. But what about the person? What if you have a heterozygous woman? Some of her cells will contain the product of one allele, and some of her cells will contain the product of the other allele. So overall, she will contain both. So for the organism, but not the cell, you have to consider the issue of dominance. If half of the person's cells are making product of big A, the genotype may be like big A, or it may be in between, or in fact, it may be like little a. So in a case like hemophilia or colorblindness, which is sex-linked, at the cell level, there's no dominance. But there is, for the person, a woman who is heterozygous for colorblindness or hemophilia does not have a problem. Now, I want to move on and consider how you do this kind of analysis for humans. We discussed last time at the very end that you cannot get humans to do crosses on demand. So in fact, you have to do it sort of backwards. You look at a family tree or a pedigree where the crosses have been done for you, and you have the phenotypes. And you reason backwards, what were the genotypes, what were the zygotes, the gametes, and the parents. So in order to do an example, which I think makes it clearer, you want to look at the handout from last time, which is 21B. And we have here a pedigree. We have two pedigrees. So let's look at the top one. And these are very small, simple pedigrees on purpose because they're better to deal with as examples the first time. Now, these are the standard symbols that are used in pedigrees. A circle means a female. A square means a male. Empty means normal phenotype. Now, remember, this is phenotype and not genotype. Normal phenotype. And filled in means has whatever it is we're discussing. Is affected. And has the condition, whatever it is, we happen to be following. Affected is not the same as infected. Infected means that some organism, like a virus or a bacterium, has invaded you. Affected means you show the symptoms of whatever genes you happen to have inherited. So this could be extremely tall height. This could be peculiar eye color. This could be any of those things. But this person has the unusual condition, and all the rest have the usual. Now, in a pedigree this small, it would be simple enough to call them persons 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But pedigrees can get very large and complicated. So it's customary to use Roman numerals for the generations. We have here generations 1, 2, and 3, and then to count from the left. So this is first generation person 1, first generation person 2, etc. So what would you call this person? The generation is 3, and the person is 1, 2. So this would be 3, 2. Now that we've said that, how do you analyze the pedigree? Now, in the previous case, we predicted proportions. But that's only for large numbers of offspring. So you can't do this by proportions. You have to do it by possible, impossible. Is it possible for these parents to have these children or for these children to have these parents given a certain pattern of inheritance? You do it by trial and error. So, okay, what do you think? Shall we try recessive first or dominant? Everybody asleep today? Recessive. So let's try recessive. So what you do is you try and give everybody a genotype that fits your theory. And if you can give everybody a genotype, then it's possible. So let's try it. So what if this is a recessive condition, what's the genotype of this person? This person has to be little a, homozygous recessive. Well, in that case, what about the parents? Where did the little a's come from? Must have got one from each parent. Now we have to ask what goes in the blank. Well, it has to be big A, because if it was little a, the parents would have whatever it is, and the parents don't. So they must have a big A, so they have normal phenotype. What about the kids? So that's okay. These parents could have this child could have those parents. Now, what about the fact that both of these are normal? Well, do they have any little A's? They must have got one from this parent. So they must be, again, little a blank. What goes in the blank? Big A by the same argument. So there's only one person left. What about the spouse here? Do we know anything? Must have a big A because they look normal and their kids got it. What's in the blank? We don't know, but if this condition is rare and these folks are unrelated, we assume it's big A. It's probably big A, unless this condition is rare, is common. If this condition is common, then this person could have a little a. Now, if this was, in fact, a little a, could they have normal children? Two in a row? It's a pretty small sample. Why not? So this is fine. This condition could be recessive. Could it be dominant? We have to do it all over again. And in order not to make it too complicated, I'm going to draw it over here again. You can try drawing it a different color or a different way to see if it'll work. Well, suppose it is dominant. Then what is the genotype of our affected person? Well, I'm not going to use A's this time because it gets too confusing. So I'm going to use D because for dominant. So how many dominant alleles does this person have? Well, at least one, right? And if the condition is rare, probably only one. Now, could this person have two normal kids? Well, they get little d from here. That's okay. What's the genotype of this person? Remember, this is a dominant condition, and this person doesn't have it. So, in fact, this time we know this person is little d, little d. So, yeah, they could have got little d from the other parent. Now, the point so far is there is nothing wrong with a dominant parent having normal children. No problem. But what about the parents? Where did big D come from? Nowhere is the right answer. So unless this person is a mutant, there is no way this can be dominant. Because these parents, what do they have to be? They both have to be little d, so they don't have a big D to give this person. So unless, if it's just being passed along, a person with a dominant allele must have got it from one of their parents, and they didn't. The problem here is the parents. This setup is not consistent with dominant inheritance. So in fact, this must be a case of recessive inheritance. Now, of course, in real life, you would look at many more cases, many more such marriages, many more children to confirm, but it looks pretty straightforward. So we can forget about this. Not possible. Now, what about the next one on the bottom? I want you to try that. By the way, I didn't ask if it would tell you if it was sex-linked or not. You try that one for yourself. But now, what about the other pedigree? I want you to try that one. I'll draw it here. Now, could this be dominant or recessive? And I'm going to make the assumption right off that this is a rare condition. So you try it and discuss it with the person next to you. What do you think? Could this be dominant or could it be recessive? And we're sticking to autosomal for now. Now, I strongly suggest that if you're sitting all by yourself in the back, you think about moving next to somebody. You don't have to, but you might think about it. Okay, so let's take a vote on this one. How many people think it's probably dominant? How many people haven't made up their minds yet? That's actually quite a large proportion. So I'm not sure. We probably should wait a little bit longer. Okay. So let's wait a little bit longer and keep working on it. Well, we said it's rare, right? How does that influence it?
Well, I guess the question is whether you're looking for possible or you're looking for impossible.
Which is the horse and which is the zebra? What? No, we're not saying anything about linkage or sex or anything else, but let's try again now. Could this be dominant?
Yes.
Could it be recessive?
Yes.
If it's rare, is it likely to be recessive?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Let's think about that. If it's recessive, I agree with everybody, it could be dominant. But could it be recessive? If it's recessive, what's the genotype here? This is little a, little a. That's okay. What's this one then? Little a, little a. If it's recessive, what's the genotype of this one? Remember, you've got two little a's? So this one has to be big A, little a. Now, if it's a rare condition, what is the chance that this person is a carrier? Not very good. So if these people are unrelated and it's a rare condition, it is very unlikely that this person is a carrier. To put it another way, you have to assume this person is a carrier in order to fit this pedigree. And that is quite unlikely. So this is far more likely to be dominant than it is to be recessive. You haven't ruled out recessive, but it's very unlikely. It's worth trying sex linkage for both of these when you get home to see if you can rule it in or out. I think the answer, but not the details, are in the notes. Now, how would you check to be sure about this one? Again, you would have to look at many more families like this, many more cases, and many more offspring to see which it really was. Okay. So the idea here, then, is it's not the proportions, but what's possible and what's impossible that really counts. Now, before I go on, let me ask if there are questions about pedigrees before we take up the next topic. Did I say there's only one copy of the gene turned on in each cell? Only for genes on the X. Not for genes on an autosome. Okay. So all the cases we've been talking about so far, we have worried about one gene at a time. We have looked at the inheritance of two or three alleles of the same gene, but it's always been one gene. And now I want to up the ante and start considering what happens if you think about two genes at the same time. For example, suppose you have someone who is homozygous for both A and B, dominant, and someone who is homozygous, or an organism, for little a, little b. These are the parents. What will be the F1 and the F2, the first and the second generation? Now, to make this simple, we're going to start with the assumption that the A's are on one pair of homologs and the B's are on a different pair of homologs. So the double dominant parent looks like this. The double recessive parent, it's just little letters. But the point is the A's are on one pair of homologs and the B's are on another. There is no linkage. When we finish this example, we'll consider what happens if the A's and the B's are on the same pair of homologs. But for now, no. Well, what about the first generation? What are you going to get? Now, the usual routine is we figure out the gametes, we figure out the zygotes, etc. But I think in this case, we can take a shortcut. Because what can this person pass on? What version of A? What version of B? It's pretty obvious. This person's going to pass on big A, big B. This person's going to pass on little a, little b. And we're going to get a heterozygote. Now, you should be sure that you agree that this person's gametes are going to be big A, big B. If you think they're going to be big A, or big B, big B, then you should go see why not. Put them on the gene, put them on the chromosomes, push them through meiosis, and you'll see. So let's come back to this. So now we're saying the F1 is just a hybrid. Now this is hybrid or heterozygous for two genes. So when you do a cross of one double heterozygote cross another, that's called a dihybrid cross. By contrast, the one we drew up there is a monohybrid cross. Only one, that is the big A, little a, cross big A, little a. So what's going to be the next generation? Well, this time I think we better be more careful and ask, what kind of gametes are we going to get out of each of these? How many different kinds and in what proportions? And to answer that, you really want to look at the handout for today on side, I think, B. Yes, side B. So you want to look on the right-hand panel of side B. Now what we've done here is to start with a pair of chromosomes. One pair of chromosomes has the A's, and one pair of chromosomes has the B's. Now, what's going to happen before you can have any division at all? Meiosis, mitosis, doesn't matter. You have to double the DNA. Remember, each of these is a chromosome with one chromatid. How many DNA molecules in here?
One
double-stranded DNA molecule in here, one double-stranded in here, one in here, one in here. So now we have to double that DNA so that we have two chromatids per chromosome. And I put the centromere at the end of the small chromosomes and near one end of the large ones. Now, what's going to happen at first division? We've got to line up, if this is meiosis, we have to line up homologs at first division. And what are the possibilities? Now, in your handout, we've actually written both of them. I'm going to write them over here for now. One possibility is that the two straight chromosomes will end up on one side of the equator and the two wigglies on the other. Is this going to happen every time? The whole point of this is that the big chromosomes line up, who's on top, random from the way the small chromosome pair lines up, who's on top. So half the time, it's going to be wigglies on one side, straights on the other, and half the time, it's going to be mixed. So we've drawn that on the other side. Now, we mentioned that this independent lineup business before, but what are the genetic consequences of it? Well, at first division, then, we're going to have a separation along the dotted lines. What's above goes to one pole, and what's on the bottom goes to the other. So, at the end of first division, in the left case, the two straights end up in one cell, and the two wigglies end up in one cell. But in the other case, it's mixed. Now, what happens in second division? Who separates from whom in second division? Homologs? No, we just did that. Now we're going to separate sister chromatids. And so when we do that, from this top cell here, from here, we're going to get two cells with a wiggle and with two straights. And from this bottom cell, we're going to get two cells with all wigglies. But what about the other case? When these two separate, when the sister homologs separate, we're going to get a straight big chromosome with a wiggly small. And from the other cell, we're going to get, I'm going to draw it down here to make it parallel, a wiggly big and a small straight. Well, what's with the A's and the B's? The way we drew it, the capitals were on the straights. So these are big A's. And the little A's are on the wigglies, the big wigglies. And now the B's, the big B is on the straights. And the little B is on the wigglies. Well, what does this say? This says in any one meiosis, how many kinds of gametes do you get? In any one meiosis, do you get four different kinds? Well, let's look over here. When it comes to A's and B's, what have you got here? These are both the same, big AB. These two are the same, little AB. But what about the other case? These two are the same, big A, little B. And these two are the same, little A, big B. So you get four gametes each time. But from any individual meiosis, how many different kinds? Only two. A single meiosis either gives you big AB and big little AB, or it gives you big A, little B, little A, big B. Which kind of meiosis is more likely? Right or left? Okay, let's take a vote. Which is more likely? This one? This one? Why this one?
This is more randomness.
This seems more randomness, but the random... Let me put this mic back. The randomness comes at this point. Which of these is more likely? Well, it's not. These are equally likely. This is like flipping a coin. Once you've got this one right, you flip a coin about the second one. Once you've got this one way, you flip a coin about the second one. And if you think about this way, heads could come up, so you do this, or tails could come up, so you do this one. So what this says is each of these is equally likely. So each of these outcomes is equally likely. Now, once I say it that way, overall, from many meioses, what do you get? How many kinds of gametes? Well, everybody agrees you get four. But what we've said is you're going to get these two kinds just as often as these two kinds. Because of what we know about the mechanism of meiosis. Now, there's another way to put this. If a gamete gets big A, is it more likely to get little B or big B? Well, half the time it gets big B, and half the time it gets little B. The distribution of the A's is independent of the distribution of the B's. Either A is equally likely to go with either B. And we went through this whole routine because it's non-obvious. And this is called, as it says on the top of your handout, independent assortment. The A's are distributed or assorted independently of the B's and vice versa. So either A is equally likely to go with either B is equally likely to go with either A. So the bottom line is, after all of this, you get four kinds of gametes in equal proportions if there are many meiosis. Well, okay, back to our cross. Let's look at the other side of the handout again. And you notice that we've written at the top of the page the dihybrid cross. So we just figured out, okay, these are the parents, that's step one. What are the gametes? What possible gametes can you get out of here? Well, somebody said AB, but that doesn't help too much. Good try. But it's going to be capital A with which B? You're going to get that one. Are we going to get capital A with anything else? With little b. Then we're going to get little a with big B. Little a with little b. So we're going to get all four possible kinds and from many meiosis in equal proportions. What are we going to get from the other parent? Same old thing. So how do you figure out the offspring? Well, you got to figure out the zygotes. What happens if equal proportions of these make equal proportions of the same? So one way to do it is to make a 4x4 Punnett square, which is written right there on your handout. And that will work. However, that is the hard way. Now, it will work if this is all you're asked to do. But suppose some nasty person like Dr. Moshowitz says, what is the result of this cross the same thing? You would not want to make the square for a 5 hybrid cross. You would be here till next week. So there's an easy way of doing both of these. And that's to go back to this important point that the A's are distributed independently of the B's. Therefore, I can calculate the A part, I can calculate the B part, and I can put it together. And that's what's on the next part of your handout. So instead of doing it this way, you say, well, what if I did the A part? I know how to do that. How many gametes from here? How many kinds? Gametes. Well, I can pass, what can I pass on?
Big A, big A.
Big A or little A. No, we're just talking gametes, not zygotes. So gametes, I can pass on big A or little A. Gametes, I can pass on big A or little A. So I can fill it in. So I can get these four possible combinations in the zygotes. But as we explained last time, two of these are the same. This heterozygote and this heterozygote are the same. But this is going to be big A, big A, and this is going to be little a, little a. So although there are four squares here, as we explained above, you're really going to get three kinds. Homozygous either one and heterozygous in 1 to 1 to 2. Now the truth is, if you forget this, it's very easy to do and fairly fast. What's with the B's? It's exactly the same thing. So what this tells me is 1/4 of the A's offspring are going to be big A, big A. 1/2 are going to be big A, little a. And 1/4 are going to be little a, little a. And similarly for the B's. 1/4 homozygous B, big B, etc. All right. But now remember, the A's and the B's are distributed independently. So what does that mean? I'm going to erase some to make some space here. That means now that I can say, okay, there's 3 A combinations I can get out of here. And there are 3 B combinations. We're talking zygotes now, not gametes anymore. There's 3 possible A combinations in the gametes and 3 possible B's. Which A combination can go with B's? Of my 3 B combinations, which ones can go with this? All of them. So now I can draw it this way, this branching diagram, saying that 3 different B combinations can go with my first A combination. How many B combinations with this A combination? Same 3. How many B's with here? Same 3. How many different genotypes can I get out of this? This is not a trick question. 9. It's obvious. Now, if I did the 4x4 square, I would have 16 squares. And I would have to go through them very carefully to be careful to check that 9 of them were unique and the others were duplicates. I didn't have to do that. From this, I know immediately that there are 9 possibilities. Now, you could do it for 5 deep. It just takes a lot more paper. Now, this gives me the number of genotypes. But what proportions are they in? Well, what proportion are big A, big A? We know that's a quarter. What proportion are big B, big B? That's also a quarter. Now, what is the chance of being both? Of being big A, and big B, big B? Since these are independent events, all you have to do is multiply the two probabilities. And means multiply. So you take the chance of big A, which is one quarter, times the probability or chance of big B, which is one quarter. And that tells me that 1/16 will be both big A, and big B, or 1/16. Now, if I had done the big square of 4 by 4, one square in there would be big A, big B, big B. This is an easier way of figuring that out. How about this one? Big heterozygous A and heterozygous B. What would that be? So let's just take a minute and people figure that out to see if they got it. See. Okay, is it going to be a... What, okay, what do we take for choices here? Let's try... What is the proportion going to be? Well, what's the proportion of big A, little a? You go over here, it's a half. What's the proportion of big B, little b? It's a half. So it's a half times a half or a quarter. Now, this one is really a lot easier to figure out than if you had done the big square. Because if you'd done the big square, this means 4 squares out of 16 would have been this, and you'd have to count them all up. But you didn't have to do that. All right, so you could fill the whole thing in if you had to, but we're going to spare you the need. But now we aren't finished. We have figured out the genotypes of the offspring or the zygotes. What are the phenotypes? What are these things going to look like? How many different phenotypes and in what proportions? Well, in order to figure that out, just as with a single monohybrid cross, we have to ask, what does allele big A do? What does allele little a do? What does big B do? What does little b do? We have to make some assumptions. So we've made a set here to make life easy, but you see in that little box on the right there, bottom right, we're assuming that that gene A codes for enzyme A. More correctly, we probably should say gene alpha. And big A gives you working enzyme. And little a gives you inactive or no enzyme. Similarly, big B gives you enzyme. And little b, inactive enzyme. Now, we're assuming, we also have to ask, what do the enzymes do? So we're assuming, as you see it's written there, that enzyme A is in charge of some reaction, which we've called X to Y, which involves some trait or other. And we've assumed that enzyme B, I'm going to write it over here so you can see it, that enzyme B controls some other unrelated reaction, which is involved in some other pathway, some other trait, unrelated. So I wrote, let's see, K to Z. Okay. Now, once we've said all of that, what does that mean? How many different phenotypes do we have here? You can do this job, whatever enzyme B is supposed to do, and you can do whatever enzyme A is supposed to do. So phenotype one is you can do both of them. What other phenotypes are there? You can't do either one. They're both messed up. No enzyme B, block here. No enzyme A, block here. Anything else? Oh, you could have one and not the other. So you could be able to do the enzyme B job, but not the A, or the enzyme A job and not the B. These jobs are independent. You can do one without the other, no problem. So, there are only 4 phenotypes. We just figured that out. So we did genotypes, of which there are 9. And there are 4 phenotypes. Now, what genotype goes with what phenotype? To do the A job and the B job, what do you have to have? A big A and a big B. So if you are big A, whatever, big B, whatever, then you can carry out both jobs. Who can't do anything? Only little A, little A, little B, little B. Now, who can do the A job but not the B job? Big A something, but can't do the B job, so it has to be little B, little B. And the other one is little A, big B, blank. So this is both jobs, A job only, B job only, neither. What proportions will they be in? Well, if we knew what proportion were A blank and what proportion were B blank, what would we do? We would just multiply because we wanted to know who's both. But what does A blank mean if we break it down? Big A, big A, or big A, little A. Now, you can't be both at the same time. You have to be one or the other. If you have choices which are exclusive, and you know the chance of one and the chance of the other, the chance of one or the other is their sum. So just like and means multiply, or means add. So what's the chance of big A, big A? What is it? 1/4. What's the chance of heterozygous? 1/2. So in fact, A blank is the chance of AA plus the chance of heterozygote, or 3/4. So what's the chance of a double heterozygote? What's the chance of an A heterozygote? 1/4 or 3/4? It's 3/4. The chance of being either big A, big A, or big A, little A, which is big A blank, is 3/4. So the chance of this one is 3/4. The chance of this one is 3/4. The chance of being both is 9/16. The chance of this one is 3/16. What's the chance of this one? It's actually the same. And the chance of this one is 1/16. Now, let's see, be sure it adds up. Yes, 7/16. This is the famous Mendelian ratio of 9 to 3 to 3 to 1. What did we have to assume? The 2 genes were inherited independently. There was complete dominance. And the product of each gene acted independently from the product of the other gene. All of this was true. Now, before I go further, let me ask what questions there are about this. Yeah?
If you said, what's the chance of being a double heterozygote, would that mean big A, little A, big B, little B?
Yes. No. Yes, it would. And I may have said it wrong. Okay. That the chance here is not of being a double heterozygote, but of having one big A and one big B.
Okay.
You're quite right. It doesn't matter what's in the blank. That's right. So that's why it's 9/16 instead of 1/2 times 1/2. Any more questions about this? Yeah.
If I wasn't able to see the 1/4 of the big B, little B, and the genotype, would I have to make the whole grid? Like, is there any easy way to just see?
So you just want to know one case, right?
Yeah.
Which case do you want to know?
Big A, little A.
Big A, little A? Yeah. Big A, little A. Big B, little B. Suppose you're doing this whole big cross. You know to know what proportion are going to have this genotype. Okay, do you need the whole shebang? Well, if all we know is we did 2 of these cross each other, right? from that cross, what proportion would be big A, little a? You know how to figure that out. From that cross, what proportion would be big B, little b? You know how to figure that out. So in fact, you can get, by multiplying them together, the chance that you can be double heterozygote without knowing anything about the rest of it.
But we'd have to do the grid for the little b, big b, for the a's and b's.
Well, either you would have to know in your head this one, or you'd have to do it. But since it's so short, it's not a big deal. Other questions? Okay. Now, I want to up the ante. We have been assuming that not only were the genes inherited independently, but the product of A and the product of B acted independently. Each one was an enzyme for some different pathway, different trait, no relationship. Well, another way of putting it is we've been assuming so far that the relationship is one gene, one trait, or one gene, one property. This is not always the case. Now, everything we've said so far is one gene, one trait. If you vary which alleles of this gene you have, you vary the corresponding trait, whether you have blue or brown eyes, whether you have cystic fibrosis or not, whether you have sickle cell disease or not. It's all due, one gene controls one trait. However, it's often more complicated. Often, one gene confects, in fact, several traits or different properties. It's not really true with sickle cell disease that the state of that gene affects only one thing. The state of your sickle cell gene, what genotype you have, affects both whether you get sickle cell disease or not, whether you're resistant to malaria, and whether you get anemia, and a whole bunch of other things. So often it happens that the state of one gene affects many properties because it affects protein in many parts of your body, or for some other reason. This phenomenon is called pleiotropy. It means from one gene, many effects. Well, what about the other way around? Is it possible to have two genes, so we'll call them gene 1 and gene 2, and they affect the same trait? Is your eye color really determined by only one gene? Fat chance. Is your height determined by one gene? No. It depends on how much growth hormone you make, how much growth hormone receptor you make, and a whole bunch of other things. We could go on. Almost all traits that are worth talking about are influenced by more than one gene. Now, it's true that there are plenty of cases like these inherited one monogenic diseases like PKU, cystic fibrosis, galactosemia, where one gene determines whether or not you have the disease. But think about pathways. How many genes affect one pathway? Whatever the number is, it isn't usually one. It's bigger. So let's consider this possibility. What if it's two genes affecting a single trait? How will that trait be inherited? So one possibility is we go back to our two genes. We could call them A and B or alpha and beta. And let's suppose that we'll call one of them gene A. It would probably be better to call it alpha. And then you have gene beta. This way I can distinguish the gene from the alleles. So what we're saying is that gene alpha codes for some protein, A, and gene beta codes for protein B. Now what we said in our previous case was gene A was involved in some process, the protein A was involved in some process, and protein B was involved in a different process. But suppose both of these proteins are subunits of the same enzyme. Many enzymes have multiple subunits. Well, in that case, you need this enzyme to do something. Let's say convert X to Z. Well, what difference will this make? If you start with big A, little a, cross big B, little b, you're going to get these 9 genotypes in these same proportions. But now, how many phenotypes are you going to have? There's only one enzymatic step here, and you can do it or you can't. Now, there are two ways to define the phenotype. It may be you need this enzyme to get rid of X, in which case you talk about X plus and X minus. Able to degrade X, not able to degrade X. On the other hand, maybe the really important part is being able to synthesize Z. Then you talk about Z plus or Z minus, able to make Z, not able to make Z. Either way you look at it, there are two phenotypes. You can do it or you can't. But since there are only two phenotypes, what are the corresponding genotypes? We still have the same 9 genotypes, but which ones are able to do it and which ones can't? Well, what genotype corresponds to ability to carry out that reaction? It's easier if we look at these 4 here, we can collapse it. Which of these 4 can do the job? Only the top one. You need one big A and one big B. If you have one big A and one big B, you have both subunits of enzyme, you can carry out your reaction, you're okay. But what if you're little a, but big B? Can you do it? No. And this one can't do it either, and neither can this one. So in fact, if you got down to a heterozygote, double heterozygote, cross a double heterozygote, what proportion of the offspring could do it? Nine sixteenths can do whatever it is, and the rest of them, 7/16, cannot. So instead of getting the famous 9 to 3 to 3 to 1, you'd get 9 to 7. 9/16 can do it, 7/16 cannot. All right. Now let's consider a related case. Suppose the pathway is really X to Y to Z. And let's say protein A really is enzyme A for step 1, and enzyme B is for step 2. So this time, gene alpha makes enzyme A, step 1. Gene beta makes enzyme B, step 2. Well, if Y isn't good for anything, then the only point of this is to get from X to Z. Getting halfway there is no use anyway. So in that case, who can get from X to Z? Is it any different? Notice it's exactly the same. If you can't do step A or you can't do step B, you're in the same pickle. You can't get from X to Z. But consider a more interesting case. Suppose all 3 are different. Suppose getting to Y is actually useful. Y is something important. This is the easiest to see if we use color. Let's suppose this one is colorless or white. If you make Y, you're brown. And if you make Z, you're black. Now, in the 2 previous cases, either you were white or black, and that was the end of it. But in this case, you have a 3rd possibility, white or brown or black. Now, which genotypes are which? Another way of asking this question is if we do a double heterozygote cross a double heterozygote and we look at the offspring, will we get more white or more brown? So you do this one. And you look at the offspring. So, comparing the proportions, are you going to get more white or more brown? So I want you to look at this for a minute, discuss this one with your neighbor, and then we'll see what the answer is. Let me write it down. I know what I should have done. I should have asked you first and then let you discuss it. We voted twice, but we're not going to do that. Okay. All right, I'm going to take a vote, and this time, to keep you honest, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes just for a minute. How many people think you got more brown? How many people think you got more white? How many people are undecided? Okay, you can open your eyes. So the votes are more people thought white. A reasonable number of people thought brown, and a not insubstantial minority were undecided. So how do you settle this? What genotypes correspond to what? We know we're going to get 9-3 to 3-1. So we have to figure out who's going to be brown and who's going to be white. Now, who's going to be black, by the way? Only these are going to be black. That we understand. But now, who's going to be brown? To be brown, what has to work? This has to work. What if this also works? No good, you're black. So if this one works and this one does not, you're brown. So let's see, which one is that? That's this one. This one's black, this one's brown. Now what about these two? We know about this one, right? This one's obviously white. This is the interesting one. If you can't do A, does it matter if you can do B? And the point is no. If you can't get to first base, you never get to third base. Out of the question. So in fact, once the first step is messed up, once the first step is on the same run, you know, once you get to... Ha ha. If you can't do the first step, it doesn't make any difference about the second one. So these two now are combined. And again, this time we have three phenotypes. And what are the ratios going to be? Black to brown to white is going to be 9-3-4. Now, this case has a particular name. This case is called epistasis. And because what's happening here is that the effect of gene A, if it is homozygous recessive, masks the state of gene B. So if you're little a, you can't tell what the B's are. They could be either way. So little a, blank, blank is anything, is all the same. So they say the gene A is epistatic to gene B. Now this epistasis business often comes in handy in trying to figure out which step comes first or whether things are in the same pathway or different pathways. Now epistasis is often confused with dominance. They're both cases of something overriding something. But they're quite different. Because when you talk about dominance, who's overriding whom? It would be one allele of the same gene overriding another allele of the same gene. Big A versus little a, big B versus little b. But when you talk about epistasis, you're talking two genes, not two alleles of the same gene. You're saying the effects of gene alpha or A are overriding or masking the effects of gene B or beta. So that's how they're different. Now, all the cases we've talked about so far, the genes themselves were inherited independently. Their products didn't necessarily act independently, but the genes were inherited independently. And what I want to talk about next is what if the genes are actually linked if they are on the same chromosome. So before I do that, let me ask what questions there are about this. And since there aren't any, at least not yet, we want to go back and consider a different situation. So you want to look back to 22B again. And you want to consider the other possibility. So the right-hand side of the handout considered independent assortment. But now, what if the A's and the B's are on a pair of homologs? So we don't have two homologs. Two pairs of homologs. We only have one. And the A's are on this, and so are the B's. Now, I have arbitrarily put big A, big B on one chromosome, and little a, b on the other. I could have started out with a different combination, but the point is that the A's and the B's are both on the same homolog. Well, so what? Well, before you can do anything, of course, you have to double the DNA. So I'm just going to cheat and do it. It's on your handout. And now, what if this thing goes through meiosis? What is going to happen? Well, one possibility is that there is no crossing over at all in this meiosis involving the space between A and B. No crossing over. So then, what's going to happen at first division? This is where it says one. What's going to happen at first division? We're going to separate homologs. So one daughter cell is going to get the straight chromosome, and one is going to get the doubled wiggly. And then, of course, at second division, we're going to get two straights and two wigglies. That is, we're going to get four cells, and two of the cells are going to get copies of the straight chromosome, and two of the cells are going to get copies of the wiggly. That's if there's no crossing over. How many kinds of gametes in what proportions? Well, maybe we should put the A's and the B's on. The capitals go on the straights. So these are both going to be big A, big B. These are both going to be little a, B, little a, B. How many kinds of gametes? I only got two. I got the same combination I started with on the original chromosomes, either big A, big B, or little a, little b. That's no crossing over or complete linkage. But we know that crossing over can occur. And what happens if there is one crossing over event between the straight and the wiggly? Now, maybe we should blow that up a little bit. What do we mean by a crossing over event? One event means that we cut one of the straight chromatids and we cut one of the wiggly chromatids. Both double-stranded. And then what we're going to do is we're going to connect one end of the straight to one end of the wiggly and the other end of the wiggly to the other end of the straight. Now, this is a single cut and rejoin event. But if I do it, I'm going to get what I have over here. I'm going to join this one to here and this one to there. I'm going to end up now with this top straight chromatid was not affected at all. But now this arm of this chromatid has a part wiggly and a part straight. Similarly, the bottom chromatid, no, this is just a line here. The wiggly on the bottom, the wiggly chromatid, doesn't get affected at all, but it has a wiggly section and a straight. Now, because crossing over occurs after DNA replication, there are four copies of the DNA here. This is a 4C cell. And only two of the chromatids at a time engage in the act. So we have two recombinant chromatids and two normal ones, unaffected. So now, first division would separate our two homologs, and second division would separate the two chromatids at the top and the two chromatids at the bottom. So what are we going to end up with? All four are going to be different. Because one cell gets the straight, one cell gets the wiggly, one cell gets the left wiggly, right straight, and one gets the left straight, right wiggly. Now, what's with the A's and B's? Straights have capitals, so this is big A, big B. What's this one? This is little a, big B. This is little. This is big A, little b. And this one is... No, this is big A, big B. This is all wiggly. And this is a big A, little b. Yep, it is. Oh, this one's wrong. Yeah, this one is little a, little b. And this one is big A, little b. How many kinds? Four in equal proportions. So what goes on here? If there's no crossing over, you only get whatever you started with. If there's crossing over, then in that meiosis, you get equal numbers of switched and originals. Now, which meiosis, which way is meiosis going to go? It depends on how close A and B are together. If A and B are very close together, the chance of a crossing over falling between them is small, and most meiosis go this way, and almost all your gametes are either whatever you started with, which are called parentals. On the other hand, a few meiosis will go the other way, and you'll get a few recombinants. Little a, little b, is a what? A parental or a recombinant? Did you start with it? Yeah, so it's a parental. By definition, whatever you started with parental, the other is a recombinant. Now, I could have started with this. If I started with this, then little a, b, little b would be recombinant. So which is recombinant and which is parental depends on what I started with. But the point is that if A and B are close together, I'm going to get mostly parentals and only a few recombinants. As A and B get further apart, I get more and more recombinants up to a max of half. Now, the numbers of it we'll talk about next time. I want to explain briefly one of the uses of all this. Now, I started a few minutes late, so I'm going to run a few minutes late, but if anybody has to go, feel free. But I just want to talk about one example. But it turns out that by measuring the proportion of recombinants, or the number proportion of meiosis that have crossing over, you can figure out how far apart A and B are. This allows you to make maps. This has been very valuable in the past. The way we know that the E. coli chromosome is circular is from looking at linkage maps. Who tends to go with whom? It's obviously a circle. Your chromosomes are obviously linear. But in this day and age, we don't make the maps that way so much. But linkage is still extremely valuable in terms of prediction and gene finding. And let me just tell you one example. We've talked a lot about Huntington's disease, which is a dominant condition which leads to degeneration of muscular control and then of the brain. When you first get it, you act sort of like you're drunk, and then it gets worse and worse. Now, so far, there is no known cure for this disease, but we can predict whether somebody is likely to get it or not. Suppose somebody has it and they marry somebody who doesn't. This disease doesn't usually develop until you're 40 or 50. What is the chance this person will get the disease? This is a rare disease. So what's the genotype of this person likely to be? Dominant, big D, little d. Heterozygous, not homozygous, because it's a rare condition. And this person is normal. Well, what's the chance this person will get Huntington's? Well, it doesn't matter which allele you get from here, they're both okay. It depends which allele you get from here. What's the chance of getting the bad allele from here? It's only a half. You can make your little square if you want, but the answer is a half. So this means that if your parent has it, you have 40 or 50 years to sitting around thinking, oh my God, I just dropped something. Maybe I'm getting it. When you want to decide whether you should have children or not, you don't know if you can have it to pass on or not. This is a very undesirable state of affairs. The real truth is you either do or you don't. It's either zero or one, but you don't know which you are. Now, using linkage, people developed a test for this gene because it turns out that on the chromosome where the gene for HD is, there is next to it a polymorphic region, meaning something that's variable. We talked about polymorphic regions before. We said they could vary in number of repeats. They could vary in sequences recognized by restriction sites. The point is the sequence varies from person to person. And these regions are usually in introns or spacers between genes. They're usually not in coding sections or exons. So these are used, as we've mentioned before, in identification. These very variable regions are used to identify and to match up the suspect's DNA and what was left at the scene. So they're used a lot for identification, for paternity tests, etc. But they can also be used here for prediction. Because suppose you have a person, remember a person has, well, let's just look at this one chromosome. This version, as it turns out, this region comes in four versions, which are known as A, B, C, and D. And they differ in which restriction sites are present in here. So there are four possible versions, and its details are explained carefully in your notes. Well, suppose a person is heterozygous and has the A version on one chromosome and the B on another, and the normal allele like this. So the person has the big A version and the HD allele on one chromosome and the B version of the polymorphic site and the normal allele on the other chromosome. Well, from whether they inherit A or B, which is easy to measure, you can tell which chromosome they got, and therefore if they're likely to develop HD or not. And the closer these two are together, the more valuable it is. Because the less the chance of crossing over is switching anything. So, a classic example of this, and this is the last thing I want to mention, is suppose you have a person, say, who is, one parent is like this, and one parent is like this. Remember, everybody is diploid, not haploid, so it's a little more complicated. But now you look at the kid. The kid is either going to be AA or AB. Suppose the kid is AA. Is the kid likely to get Huntington's?
Where's the big HD on those?
Oh, I didn't put one in, did I? Well, is the kid likely to get Huntington's? In this case, yes. Because if the kid has two A's, this must have been one of them. And it doesn't matter about the other one. The kid is going to get HD, assuming there's been no crossing over. And if the kid is AB, there's nothing to worry about. Because if the kid is AB, she must have gotten B from here, got the normal allele of Huntington's, and will be okay. Now, you can understand this can get quite complicated because suppose this one is heterozygous and suppose you didn't know which of these had the HD. So it's even better if you can check for the gene itself, and people have been able to do that because by knowing just that the gene is near this polymorphic site, they were able to isolate the gene. This is called positional cloning. And in fact, how do you usually clone a gene? You know what protein it makes. From the protein, you make a probe, you fish out the DNA. Here, nobody knew what protein it made. We know now, because we've got the gene, we've sequenced the gene and figured it out. But we still don't know why it causes the disease. So I'm going to stop here. And next time, we're going to talk more about the fine points of linkage, and then we'll talk a little bit, if we have time, about selection and evolution.